Innovation applied to farming techniques created the first green revolution, when high-tech fertilizers and pesticides vastly increased crop yields. But that's not enough anymore. The world's population is growing faster than our ability to feed it, and the environmental impact of all this productivity has sometimes been devastating. So what to do? Richard Manning makes the case for a second green revolution in his book Food's Frontier. He thinks the answer lies in biotechnology and cites the work of plant pathologist Robert Goodman. Manning and Goodman talked with Steve Paulson about the prospects for feeding the world in the 21st century. Robert Goodman.
Today, in the developing countries of the world, more than a billion people live on less than a dollar a day, and 2 billion, 2.5 billion live on less than $2 a day. 800 million or more children are poorly nourished, malnourished. The projections are for the world population to increase to 8 to 9 billion conservatively over the coming generation, and no more land to turn to agriculture without very severe environmental destruction.
You're saying if the world's population is going to double, the food supply has to double, more or less.
Yes, and in parts of the world where already people are very hungry.
Now, Dick, the Green Revolution was supposed to solve this problem, wasn't it?
And it did, and created a bunch of new ones in the process. In my lifetime, or actually in the last 30 years, we doubled the human population. And back in the late 60s, people were predicting worldwide famine. The Green Revolution greatly increased production and staved off that famine and allowed that double population to be fed, where there are fewer, percentage-wise, hungry people today than there were 30 years ago. The problem is it did so in ways that are incredibly destructive environmentally, culturally. They wipe out rural communities with industrial agriculture, and the technologies have reached their limits.
Well, this is quite a challenge. I mean, you're saying that we need to double the world's food supply in the next 20 years or so because the population will increase. We more or less reached the limit of the old Green Revolution, but it had, in some ways, a rather negative legacy as well.
That's the message. And it's hard to believe for most of us in the developed world where industrial agriculture is seen to be a success and it's seen to be what sustains us and does sustain us.
So where do we go from here?
We can't go the route of industrialized agriculture where only 2% of the people grow the world's food in the rest of the world.
Well, let's talk about what's happening in the developing world. Ethiopia. Dick, I know you went there. What's being developed?
Ethiopia is kind of an interesting story in that it has its indigenous agriculture. And Ethiopians prefer a grain called teff, which only grows in Ethiopia, essentially. An Ethiopian doesn't believe that he's eaten it all until he's eaten his teff for the day.
What is teff?
It looks almost like a grass head. It's very fine grain. There are some real challenges to it. It lodges. When the grain head becomes heavy near harvest, it tips over. That's a simple explanation of it, and gets in the mud, and it spoils about half of their grain crop. And so what's happening there are some local plant breeders are trying to figure out ways to breed a new variety of teff, or engineer, even if they have to, a new variety of teff that'll stand upright. And a simple solution like that can probably increase their teff production about 40-50%.
Well, let's take this as an example. When you talk about modifying the plant, are you talking genetic engineering here?
In this case, no. This is traditional plant breeding, which we've been doing really for 10,000 years. That's what agriculture is based on. We've been doing it systematically and directly for the last 100 years. And it's also rearranging the genes, if you will, of that plant. It's just doing it in a more wholesale fashion, but that's what plant breeding is all about.
Explain that difference between traditional plant breeding and the cutting edge of genetic engineering.
Well, I'm not sure I can anymore because that line has become very blurred where breeding stops and genetic engineering begins.
Plant breeding is based on making sexual crosses between closely related plants in the same species generally. But it turns out it's possible, and it's long been known to be possible, to make what are called wide crosses. You can take distant relatives within the genus or even outside the genus. Wheat, for example, is amenable to crossing with some of its wild relatives. These methods of doing wide crosses require laboratory manipulations very often. The problem, for example, can be abortion at the point of the zygote or the very early embryo. But if you intervene with laboratory techniques, you can make a fertile plant from these wide crosses.
So once you do this laboratory work, is that what we call genetically modified food?
Well, that is clearly genetically modified food, but what I'm saying is that that is a common practice that goes back decades. We haven't focused on it publicly or in any sense. It hasn't been controversial, but it amounts to splicing very crudely genes from other plant species and other plant genera into cultivated crops.
So the question is, are these processes really different or do they amount to the same thing?
They can amount to the same thing. There are ways in which the process can be, however, very different. You can take genes from bacteria and put them in plants by DNA splicing. You could take genes from very distant organisms, fish, for example, or from trees and put them into herbaceous crops. And therein lies some of the controversy. But the point is that the manipulation of the genetic makeup of our crop plants is not unfamiliar, and our relative comfort with the products of plant breeding, even these more exotic techniques of plant breeding that we have been just talking about, comes from the familiarity and the comfort that people have because we haven't had problems with that technology.
Well, let me try to put this in perspective, because it sounds like you're saying that there's no big deal if we splice and dice the genes as finely as we want. It's just the end of a long slippery slope that's been happening for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Is that what you're saying, that there's really no danger here at a scientific level, or there are no ethical questions?
That's close. It's very close to what I'm saying. And I think about this always in terms of domestic animals instead of domestic plants, because we can trace that line. And every time I see this little beribboned yappy lap dog riding in the front seat of a Cadillac, I understand that that's a wolf. And that's a wolf with selection pressure, human selection pressure on it. So that is a very long, slippery slope. Now, there are some dangers inherent in this, and I go into one case in the book that it does have some inherent dangers when we start messing with wild populations and we can't control the results of this. But whenever I hear someone say genetic engineering could cause an environmental catastrophe, I have to remind them farming is an environmental catastrophe and has been for 10,000 years.
Bob, what about you? You're a scientist. You're working on the front lines here. Do you make any distinctions in terms of the level of intervention?
The way I would come at that question, Steve, is to think about what's actually controversial and why we have a controversy. At one level, at important levels, the devil is in the details. It's how the technology is used, not the technology itself. There are things that you could do with genetic engineering, with gene splicing, that could be very dangerous. I don't think any scientists in the public sector, for sure, and even in the private sector, are knowingly doing things that they could calculate would be dangerous. The unfamiliarity with the consequences or the results of the technology, to me, are not a reason for not proceeding, but they're a reason for when we proceed, proceeding with caution.
So all the concern, all the public concern about genetically modified food, what in Europe is being called Frankenfood, you're saying that's just way overblown. This is public paranoia.
It's a political controversy, not scientific, and it gets back to the drawing of the line. What's the difference between breeding and genetically modified foods? And that's a very gray area. But I think also the problem with that is not so much that it's overblown, but it's missing some of the key points, especially the social points of this technology. Distribution of technology is a really important issue, especially in the developing world. And any time you squeeze a balloon, it's going to pop up somewhere else, and that's true of this technology. If we are able to eliminate it in Europe or in the United States or eliminate it from the public sector in those areas, the corporations are still going to do it to some degree. China will certainly do it to some degree. There's no way you can regulate the Chinese not to do this, and they're very good at it. The Cubans are very good at it. A lot of people are going to do this. But if you don't give access to this technology to people in the developing world, it'll be very much like not giving them access to computers, because a generation ago, people feared computers as a control mechanism, and they won't have this technology as it develops into something very important.
So to return to our original question about how to feed the world in the next 20 years, how to feed all of this doubling of the population, you're suggesting we have to employ all of the new technologies that are available, which includes genetically modified food, but it goes way past that. Am I getting it right?
I think what we're going to have to do is build the kind of intellectual infrastructure in each of the developing countries and let them decide what technologies to employ and make sure the range is available to them and decide what's appropriate. And in many cases, it's going to take every trick we have. It takes all the running we can do to stay in the same place. That's been the story of the human condition now for 10,000 years, and it's not going to stop.
Richard Manning's the author of many books, including Food's Frontier, The Next Green Revolution. Robert Goodman is a plant pathologist at the University of Wisconsin. Steve Paulson talked with him.